Pseudopod, episode 114, All Hallows Eve, 2008. This week's story, The Cellar, by Stephen Owen.
Hello, welcome to Pseudopod, the weekly horror podcast. I'm your host, Alistair Stewart, and this week's story comes to us from Stephen Owen. Stephen's work has been published in numerous other places, including 13, Dark of Night, and Demon Minds, and this is his first appearance with us. Your reader this week is Ian Stewart, professional voice actor and ghost tour guide. So, get ready to have a look around a most undesirable property, because I have a story for you, and I promise you, it's true.
The Cellar by Stephen Owen. Mr. Sinclair, the smiling old man introduced himself. Not too early, am I?
Whatever you're selling, I ain't interested, said the man, ignoring Sinclair's offer of a handshake. He was taller than Sinclair by a couple of inches, probably in his mid-40s, with cropped blonde-grey hair and a permanent frown etched between tired-looking eyes.
Didn't they tell you? Said Sinclair, studying a piece of paper in his hand, then checking the brass door number. I've come to look round your house.
Well, no one said nothing.
It's still for sale, isn't it?
Oh, sure, yeah, but just wasn't expecting.
Of course, I can always come back another time, said the old man.
He frowned and scratched his chin.
It would be rather inconvenient, though. I've come all the way from Oxford. Traffic was an absolute nightmare.
Sinclair checked his watch, and a solitary drop of rain splashed on the glass, obscuring the face. He wiped it clean with the palm of his hand, and both men looked uneasily to the darkening skies.
"Oh, you better come in," said the blonde grey man, ushering Sinclair into the house as if he was his own father on a once-a-year Christmas visit. "Looks like it's going to piss down."
"Thank you," said the old man, following him inside. That's very decent of you."
They proceeded along a narrow hallway, past several framed pictures of wild flowers on the walls. It was difficult to tell for certain in the dim light whether they were paintings or prints. They walked to a lighted doorway about halfway down the corridor, and the blonde grey man went through into the front room.
"Lived here long?"
Sinclair said, pausing in the doorway.
"Few months."
"Oh, that all," the old man tutted. Not haunted, is it?"
The blonde grey man didn't even smile.
"Can I play?" says the pudgy red-faced kid, peering over a pile of sand.
The tall, skinny kid picks up a stone and throws it at him. It bounces off a wooden pallet and lands in a puddle next to a rusty-looking machine that looks like it's used for mixing cement.
"How old are you?" he says.
6 3/4. I'll be 7 in April."
"Ah, you're not old enough," he says. "I'm 10.
The skinny kid shakes his dark fringe from his eyes and turns away, swiftly hoisting himself through a hole in the brickwork and dropping out of sight. The pudgy kid clambers over the sand and wanders across the muddy earth to the opening in the wall. He has to stand on tiptoe to see through it.
"What are you doing?"
"Nothing."
The skinny kid doesn't even look at the pudgy kid when he talks to him. Instead, he does a tightrope walk across the rafters of an incomplete floor to what looks like a doorway without a door. The pudgy kid reaches up and jumps, gripping the cavity in the unfinished wall. He grits his teeth, kicks his feet, and feels his red face going even redder as he scrambles upwards, struggling to pull himself up into the gap. Once there, he swivels around on his knees and begins to lower himself down the other side. His body drops and his stomach slaps against the wall. His aching arms are at full stretch and he doesn't think he can hold on. It feels like his fingers are being slowly torn from his hands. He slumps to the ground, landing awkwardly.
"Bugger," he says, rubbing his foot. "I think I twisted my ankle."
The skinny kid's laugh is a spiteful sound. Daylight was fading fast, and the room looked gloomy after staring at the television for so long. But he could still make her out, standing in the kitchen doorway, arms folded over shapely breasts, cigarette in her right hand, right elbow in her left. She inhaled, the tip glowing in the murk.
"This is my last one," Sharon said, "ever."
Heard that before. Grab me another beer, will you? I mean it this time. You always mean it. She stubbed out the cigarette and skulked into the dimness, kicked off her high heels before snuggling beside him on the sofa. She wrapped both her slender arms around one of his and kissed him gently on the cheek. "Guess what?" she said, eager eyes twinkling with anticipation in the flickering television light.
"What?"
Sharon smiled stupidly.
"What?"
he repeated. His voice rippled, almost laughed the question the second time, because if she was smiling then it had to be good news, didn't it? And even if it wasn't that great, did it matter? He'd just give her the thumbs up, tell her he loved her, that'd be that. Only this time it was different. Even before she'd opened her mouth, he knew what was coming, and it was not what he wanted to hear, because it was going to change everything.
"I'm pregnant," she said.
Ross shrugged free from her, raising a fist. She might as well have called his mum a fucking whore.
"Aren't you pleased?"
"Who's the dad?" An accusing forefinger emerged from his clenched hand, trembling before her baffled face.
"Who the bloody hell do you think it is?"
She suddenly recoiled in disgust.
Multiple choice questions, eh? Jesus Christ! You think I'm fucking stupid? You think I don't know what's been going on?"
She jumped to her feet, backing away, like he was a stranger who just sexually assaulted her. She clasped her arms over her chest, gripping the silken sleeves of her billowing blouse.
"Oh, God, I was so looking forward to this moment."
Ross picked up the remote control and turned off the TV. He sat in silence with his head bowed for several seconds before standing up to face her. He looked up at her, smiled, then patted her stomach.
"I'll get me own fucking drink," he said,
then walked away to the kitchen.
"Start upstairs, yeah?"
"Whatever you say," replied Sinclair. He followed the man up an insanely steep staircase with no banister rail to grasp onto.
"Good a place as any?"
"Never expected anyone round so soon," said the grey blonde man, without looking back.
"Ain't been on the market long. And had time to clean up or nothing."
He beckoned once more as they reached the top of the staircase. They turned and walked down a cheerless corridor with no carpet and olive green walls towards the front of the house. Sinclair smiled, despite the discomfort from climbing the stairs. The pain was worse now he was older. He was sure of it.
"Sorry about the mess, like I said."
No problem," said the old man, peering into a room that looked like a wild animal had been let loose in it. He wandered over to the window and looked out.
"Most of this was fields when I was a boy, you know."
"You want to see the other bedroom?"
"Of course, it's changed a lot round here since then," said Sinclair, smiling and slipping into dreamy reminiscence.
"See that building over there? The large red brick building with the flat roof? That's my old school." The blonde grey man remained in the doorway and grunted something about having seen it before, but never knowing it used to be a school.
"You want to see the other bedroom now?"
Sinclair sighed, turned away from the window and plodded through a battlefield of discarded laundry. He followed the blonde grey man back along the characterless hallway to the first room they'd passed on the right-hand side.
"Bedroom number 2," said the man, "was going to be a nursery. But after what happened, I never really saw the point."
"Told you so." The tall, skinny kid is backtracking along the beam, horizontal arms as if he's pretending to be an aeroplane.
"You're just a little kid."
"No, I ain't." The pudgy kid wipes his eyes, grazed hands stinging.
"Even if I did let you play with me, you'd never be able to keep up."
"Yeah, I would." He pulls up his grey socks.
"Course you wouldn't. You're too fat."
"Would too," mumbled the pudgy kid.
"Okay, then. I'll give you a chance. If you want to play with me, then you've got to pass a special test."
He ruffles the pudgy kid's mop of ginger hair.
"And if you do it, then you can be my second in command."
"Really?" The tall, skinny kid shrugs as if it's no big deal and walks back to the unfinished floor, staring through the rafters.
"See that down there," he says. "That's going to be a cellar, that is."
"What's he for?" The pudgy kid stands up.
hide in dead bodies. He grins, stretching out his matchstick arms once more and sets off along the joist. He sways and wobbles with each theatrical step as if he's going to fall off any second, and then he stops about halfway and looks over a bony shoulder. You coming, or what?
Ross opened his beer and took several large gulps before slamming the refrigerator door shut. His grim reflection in the chrome-finished handle glared back, distorted and elongated like an image from a fairground mirror.
Not Andy Fitzpatrick, is it?
He didn't think she'd heard him, she was blubbering so much, so he repeated Fitzpatrick's name in a harsher tone, suggesting it wasn't so much a question he was asking, but a simple fact he thought she should face up to. Fitzpatrick invariably cropped up in times of crisis. He was supposedly Sharon's ex, and he worked most evenings behind the bar in the Duke's Head on Farmstead Street. Ross had caught them in the pub garden at a party some time back. She said she'd been comforting him. Ross said she'd been shagging him. He couldn't remember exactly how long ago it was, but that didn't really matter, did it? He'd seen Fitzpatrick checking her out plenty of times since. It didn't take an Einstein to work out what was going on. Ross finished his beer and lobbed the can into the darkened room.
Something you don't know, he said, opening a kitchen drawer.
Sharon looked up from the sofa, dark and fuzzy in the shadows.
Come here,
Ross smiled, reaching into the drawer.
I'll tell you what it is.
I remember when they built this estate, said Sinclair. There was an unexploded bomb from the war discovered in one of the cellars, and they had to evacuate the site.
You can see where I started decorating.
The blonde grey man gestured at two not very straight lengths of wallpaper stuck opposite. There were some cuddly elephants with pastel-coloured balloons tied to their trunks on it.
Found out we couldn't have kids, so I never saw the point after that.
Indeed, said Sinclair.
This is the bathroom, said the blonde grey man, turning to the room next door. Got a shower and everything.
Sinclair peered cautiously into the urine-smelling air and wondered exactly what the blonde grey man meant by everything. If he was talking about the unflushed toilet with the broken plastic seat, then it wasn't a selling point.
Live by yourself now, the old man deduced.
Yeah, ain't married no more.
The tone of the reply sounded like it warranted a response, as if he somehow expected Mr. Sinclair to heartily congratulate him on a job well done, being the world's umpteenth divorcee.
Me neither, the old man emphasised.
Want to see downstairs now?
Sure, said Sinclair.
He followed him back down the narrow staircase, the burning cramp now taking a hold. If he did buy this place, he'd get a chair lift fitted, he had no doubt.
All right,
says the pudgy kid, stretching out a chubby leg. He treads carefully onto the wooden beam and edges forward a few steps before pausing to examine his scuffed shoes. They suddenly feel like they're made of lead.
Secret is not to look at your feet. Where am I supposed to look then? Try looking where you're going.
The pudgy kid lifts his head and focuses on the older boy, who's already starting to look bored with all of this. He begins creeping slowly along the narrow strip, never once daring to actually lift his feet from the splintered surface in his slothful shuffle towards the tall, skinny kid.
Can't you go any faster than that?
The pudgy kid bites the inside of his lower lip. The tall, skinny kid's hands are propped on his hips. He's tapping his foot impatiently, and the closer the pudgy kid gets, the more he thinks the vibrations will throw him off balance. He imagines it's like the beginning of an earthquake.
Hurry up, slow coach, calls the skinny kid. Can't wait all day.
The pudgy kid stops and checks over his shoulder to see how far he's come. The pile of sand and the hole in the wall seem nothing more than distant memories, but the gaps between the rafters beneath him look very real, much wider and blacker than he first thought. He looks down at his feet and realises his heart is galloping and his head spinning.
He turns back to the taunting skinny kid, who suddenly looks a long way away and blunders towards him like an out-of-control puppet with half its strings cut. He misses a step, treading on nothing but the inescapable pull of empty air. He feels himself falling as if in a dream, and he reaches out, grabbing the skinny kid's toast-rack ribcage. They twist together, the skinny kid's legs slipping either side of the joist, and there's a ball-splitting sound when his splayed legs slam into the beam. He squeals like a wild hog and his body flips, disappearing into the gloom. The pudgy kid remains clinging to the unmade floor, staring down at the sprawled body for several minutes. Sharon was still snivelling when she eventually stood up. He could just about make her out in the dimness, blowing her nose and wiping her eyes, probably smudging cheap mascara all over her face, like she always did when she got upset. Ross gently closed the door and wondered if Andy Fitzpatrick had to put up with shit like this. He very much doubted it. He supposed affairs were about escapism, so she was probably happy when she was with him, otherwise what would be the point? Sharon slowly advanced from the darkness to the kitchen. She stood there, dishevelled, pained features squinting in the light. Ross thought she looked like she needed a cigarette.
I know it's a surprise, hon, but...
Oh, yeah, it's a surprise, all right.
What's this about, Ross?
Me, he grinned, turning, sacrificial bread knife gripped tightly in his hand. He raised the blade, wagging it the way a schoolmaster might shake a finger when scolding the most disorderly of pupils, then grabbed her by the hair and slammed her against the cupboards. He ripped the scarlet blouse open. The buttons clattered on the floor all round them as he savagely thrust the knife into her belly several times. He so much wanted to be sure he hit the bullseye at least once. She never even screamed. Mr. Sinclair was more than pleased to reach the bottom of the stairs. In his discomfort, he'd unconsciously reached for the non-existent handrail twice on the journey down, and almost lost his footing on the second occasion. He'd instinctively grasped the blond grey man's shoulder to steady himself. Thankfully, he hadn't seemed to notice. They descended the final few steps in silence and then walked down the hallway past the picture frames. This time Sinclair paused. He noticed they weren't prints or even paintings. They were real flowers, dried and pressed, neatly arranged behind the glass.
Wife Sobby, blond grey man shrugged. Forgot to take 'em with her.
Very nice.
You want to see the front room?
Mr. Sinclair followed him back into the room they'd been in when he first arrived.
Was two rooms.
The younger man waved a hand at an imperfect ceiling, where shoddy plasterwork revealed a wall had once stood.
Someone must have knocked it through.
So I see. The old man looked up, scratching his chin thoughtfully.
I remember thinking the rooms looked small when they were building these houses.
The blond grey man looked vaguely interested.
Of course, access to building sites was easy in those days, the old man explained. Wasn't like today. There weren't any fences to keep the kids out. Anyone could get in once the builders had gone home. We used the place as a playground.
Want to see the kitchen?
Sinclair nodded and they went through to the back of the house.
All refitted last year, said the blond grey man.
He looked pleased with himself, pointing around the room. Everything. He slammed a hand on one of the worktops, slightly startling Mr. Sinclair.
Black granite effect. New cooker too, the blond grey man said, now slapping his heavy hand on a gleaming hob, which looked as though it had never been used. I'm leaving the microwave too, if you want it.
The old man composed himself, ignoring the blond grey man's impressive list of kitchen appliances. Instead, he eyed the door in the corner of the room.
Is that the cellar?
What? Oh, yeah. He opened a cupboard door. Dishwasher in here, see? Washing machine in this one.
Would you mind?
The old man signalled towards the panel door. It wasn't a question, it was an instruction. He wanted the blond grey man to open it.
You okay down there?
He's asked him 5 times now, and still there's no answer. There's a ladder propped against a grey wall,
running down from whatever this room is going to be into the shadowy basement below. The pudgy kid worms awkwardly towards it. He wipes what he thinks is sweat trickling down his forehead, then leaves a trail of bloody handprints in his slug-like effort over the rafters. Within minutes he's sitting in front of the ladder, suddenly aware of a painful swelling within his scalp of matted hair.
"Must have hit me head," he mumbles to the sprawled body below as he examines the egg-shaped lump sticking out of his skull.
The metal rungs feel cold and gritty beneath his wet fingers, the air heavier and damper with each uncertain step, down, 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 deeper into that cold place which will one day be somebody's cellar for hiding dead bodies. And just when he thinks the ladder will never end, his left foot slaps into clammy, clay-like earth. He steps off the ladder.
"You okay?"
he says again, plodding through the puddles to where the older boy lies. He stands over him, narrowing his eyes, and thinks about kicking him.
"Hey, stop messing about. You said I could be your second in command."
He imagines the tall, skinny kid slowly rolling his filthy face, peering up at him through the mud and mumbling through a mouthful of sticky soil. He'd wink and tell him he's passed the test, but he's not going to make him second in command after all. He's promoting him to chief.
"But why?" the pudgy kid would frown. "I thought you were in charge."
"Not anymore," he'd say.
"I'm dead now. This is the cellar, and you better hurry up and hide me, because if anybody finds out what happened here today, you'll be in big trouble."
The pudgy kid kneels down, placing a stubby hand upon the skinny kid's shoulder. He shakes him, and the body rolls surprisingly easily. The skinny kid's head flops backwards, his expressionless gaze fixed on the cage-like rafters above them.
"You wake up now!"
yells the pudgy kid. The tall, skinny kid stays silent. Then the pudgy kid notices a ditch on the far side. He grabs the tall, skinny kid's matchstick wrists and drags his body through the sludge towards it, like a kid with a sled in the snow about to take the ride of his life down the steepest hill in the park.
"You're light as a feather," he says, splashing through the puddles.
He stops at the trench, which runs the length of the wall he climbed through, and looks into it. He can see a terracotta pipe at the bottom, partly buried in the nearest corner. The pudgy kid guesses the builders have finished doing whatever it is they do with underground pipes and begun filling the hole in. That was on Friday. They won't be back till Monday.
"Do it!"
screams the tall, skinny kid inside his head. The pudgy kid hauls him to the corner. He drops the body by the ditch and slaps it to the ground, then rolls it into the hole, head smacking against the pipe with a hollow thud.
"I'm chief!"
yells the pudgy kid, hurling handfuls of sticky dirt, and this time the skinny kid doesn't argue back, not even in his head. The pudgy kid clambers up the ladder, across the rafters, and somehow manages to scramble back through the hole in the wall. He's going home to his mum. She'll be screaming because she'll want to know how on earth he could ever get in such a state. Sometimes it was better being at home, because he didn't have to prove anything to anyone. There was no struggle. She simply collapsed to her knees and stayed that way, supported only by the handful of hair clutched in her husband's left hand. Ross yanked her head up.
"Remember that test you wanted me to have?"
Her dying eyes flickered, lazily rolling in their sockets.
"I got it done."
He wasn't sure she understood what he was saying, but he was gonna tell her anyway. It was her idea. She was the one who wanted to have a baby, for Christ's sake. He sighed and let go of her hair.
"Wanna know the result?"
She yelped as her body hit the floor, spattering a fountain of blood across the room. Ross ignored her. Instead, he turned his attentions to the Jackson Pollock mess now trickling down the white laminate cupboards. He wondered if it was just her blood he was looking at. She'd made it as far as the cellar door. Ross had no idea how long he'd been standing there, which reminded him he needed to get a clock on the wall in here. Somehow, the cheating bitch who should already be dead had crawled at least 10 feet across the linoleum floor. He tutted, shaking his head at the trail of bloody innards, as if they were nothing more than muddy footprints left by some wayward toddler who'd been splashing in the puddles in the garden. Ross edged across the room. "Where are you going?" He unlocked the cellar door and opened it. The cold, damp air surged up from below. "Don't you want to know the results of my test?" He slammed a foot in her face. Something snapped and her head bent back further than he knew it ever should. He kicked her again, and the lifeless body rolled, then silently tumbled down the stone steps to the cracked concrete floor below. "Said I can't have kids," he said, peering into the gloom. "You listening? I'm sterile." Ross returned to the refrigerator and grabbed himself another beer. He'd clean up in the morning. It had been a long day. The blonde grey man shrugged and unlocked the door. "Thought about having a pool table down here," he said, switching on the light. He beckoned once again. "Missus wasn't too keen on it, though." "I can imagine," Sinclair said. He noticed with some relief a galvanised handrail fixed to the brickwork to his right and gingerly followed the blonde grey man down into the cellar, his hand smoothly sliding around the freezing metal with each step. "Started doing the place up once she left," said the blonde grey man, waving a hand at the freshly painted white walls. The old man coughed. The damp, emulsion-smelling air stung his lungs. He stepped onto the crumbled concrete floor that had clearly seen better days and studied the unfurnished room. "I think a pool table would be admirable," he said. "Yeah? Certainly," said Sinclair, stamping one of his shiny black shoes on the floor. "Sounds hollow, doesn't it?" he said, observing the blonde grey man. "Suppose so." Sinclair sighed and checked his watch. "It's time I was going," he said. "It's a long drive back." The blonde grey man nodded, holding out a square-shaped palm, and gestured for Sinclair to lead the way. The old man smiled weakly and walked across to the stairs. "You interested in the house, then?" Sinclair never answered. He stumbled on the first step, unable to grab the handrail. His body folded as the cramp finally seized him where it hurt most. The blonde grey man lunged forward, muscular arms outstretched, and caught Sinclair before he went down. "Wish I could say it was an old war wound," gasped Sinclair, his hand clasped between his legs. "Nothing so glamorous, I'm afraid." "I was about 10 years old," Sinclair explained. The rain had stopped, and his breath steamed in the damp air beneath the blue-white glare of the security lamp. "It was an accident on a building site. Fooling around with a younger lad, we were playing on some rafters."
"You fell off?"
"I was pushed," the old man said. "Got knocked unconscious. Woke up in a ditch, freezing to death and half buried in mud. And fractured my skull and completely ruptured my testicles. Spent the next 6 weeks in hospital."
"Jesus! What happened to the other kid?"
"I suppose he panicked and ran away. I never saw him again."
"You suffered since, eh?"
"In more ways than one," said Sinclair. "My wife wanted children, and the accident left me completely sterile. I even had a test done to prove it."
"Oh, that why your missus left you?"
The blonde grey man looked embarrassed even as the words left his lips, as though he had no control over asking such a question to a man he hardly knew. "Could say that," said Sinclair. He nodded philosophically and jangled his car keys. "Anyway, it all happened a long time ago." The old man turned and walked to his Ford Mondeo, parked beneath the street lamp. He unlocked the door, opened it, and waved to the silhouette in the doorway before climbing into the vehicle. The shadowy figure raised an arm in acknowledgement. This had been Sinclair's third visit since selling up almost 30 years ago. Of course, he kept a watchful eye on the local property market ever since, because he simply couldn't resist paying her a visit each time the building went up for sale. He smiled as he drove away and briefly considered calling the estate agents to tell them that he was interested in buying the place. He dismissed the idea almost immediately. He wasn't ready to move back home just yet. Not after what she did.
We trail history like comets, leaving parts of ourselves wherever we pass. That's our dream time, the scatter of objects of memories down across the years and the locations. Anytime you wrote on a desk in school, anytime you marked something or forgot something or had something stolen, any place you were beaten or kissed, anytime you fell, anytime you won, the location is marked, whether physically or mentally. There are places in this tiny, tiny city, known for its ghosts, that I have trouble spending time in, not because of some long-dead resident, but because of me, because of the person I was when I lived there. We haunt this world, our trails sometimes crossing and sometimes joining, but in the end we are all of us ghosts, sometimes for good reasons, sometimes, such as here, for bad reasons. And speaking of good reasons, if you like this story, please go to pseudopod.org and click on Feed the Pod. Every cent you give us goes straight to our authors, so know you'll be doing some good if you do donate. Pseudopod staff, aside from our previously mentioned ninja interns, or perhaps ninjterns, consists of Captain Ben Phillips, chirpy PR officer Alistair Stewart, and expert slush commando Ellen Allen. Pseudopod's theme music is Bloodletting in the Naked Kiss by Anders Manga, whose work can be found at andersmanga.com. Pseudopod is a production of Escape Artists Incorporated and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license. I go now to prepare for my birthday, but before I do, Pseudopod wants to know, has anyone seen Sam Lowry?